Hey, Two Cities listeners, we just want to flag at the outset that this episode was recorded a number of months ago, and so you won't hear about a lot of political events that are relevant to or adjacent to the question and status of refugees. For example, the political crises at the border, the US-Mexico border, and Israel-Hamas war are events that came to the forefront well after we recorded this episode. So you won't hear us mention things and other adjacent issues that might be confusing, that we omit them. But please keep in mind when this episode was recorded. At the same time, given how certain political events have come to the fore, that makes Barney's comments in this episode all the more relevant. So with that, here's the rest of the episode. Welcome to the Two Cities Podcast, a podcast about theology, culture, and discipleship. And this is episode 219.
In this episode, we are talking about Jesus Was a Refugee with Dr. Barnabas Asprey. Dr. Barnabas Asprey is Assistant Professor of Systematic Theology at St. Mary's Seminary and University in Baltimore, Maryland, and the author of the article that we are discussing in this episode, Jesus Was a Refugee, Unpacking the Theological Implications in the academic journal Modern Theology. Team members on the episode from the Two Cities include Dr. John Anthony Dunn, Reverend Dr. Nathaniel Warren, and myself, Dr. Logan Williams. So we just had a great conversation with Barney. John and Nate, what were some of the highlights for you?
I think one of the interesting things for me, and one thing that I really appreciated, was him now taking for granted that so many authors and so many scholars and even politicians are assuming this idea of Jesus as refugee, and thus kind of like diving down into that idea and giving it some reflections, some theological resonances, but also appreciate the deep theological reflection of what it means to be a refugee as an individual that exists in the world, and then as some horrific historical reality, and thinking through those kinds of connections.
Yeah, I really appreciated the broader theological framework within which he talked about the refugee crisis. I think there's a lot here that's politically relevant and theologically rich. And so just providing a really a helpful way for us to think about this topic that is so fraught, of course, by our, you know, different political dispositions. And I just think there's so much here to think about. And I just really appreciate Barney's perspective.
One of the things I really appreciated about Barney's perspective is the way that he relates sameness and otherness. And he's going to have some really interesting reflections on how we should think about the relationship between refugees and non-refugees, and in what sense are actually all humans experiencing a reality of displacement. So I really appreciated those very nuanced thoughts, and you have that to look forward to. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. And you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at our website at thetwocities.com. And with that, here's our conversation with Dr. Barnabas Asprey. Well, Barney, thanks for joining us.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you published an article called Jesus Was a Refugee, Unpacking the Theological Implications. And that was published in Modern Theology. For any of our listeners, it's open access. You can go look up the journal Modern Theology and download a PDF of this for free. But what I wanted to ask you, Barney, was what are the circumstances that have given rise to people saying that Jesus was a refugee? Because you note, and I think people will probably know, that people do say this a lot. People talk about the flight to Egypt as the Holy Family participating and,
becoming refugees for at least for that time. But why? That's not, people haven't been saying that for centuries. Why is that now a thing that has come up that people now say? What are the kind of circumstances, various kinds of refugee crises that have led to Christians, lay and academic, saying this slogan that Jesus was a refugee?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I mean, I don't know what to say that isn't kind of common knowledge here. I mean, we're all aware in the news that immigration and especially refugees is a topic that comes up quite a lot. It's quite a politically contentious topic. And in many Western nations, it's one of the top issues, one of the number one issues that decides who people vote for. That's a decisive issue when people are thinking which political party they want to support. They look at their position regarding immigration, their position regarding refugees. So it's that kind of a hot political topic. I've always believed that theology should not be afraid of being intensely and deeply theological, and it shouldn't just always be trying to be relevant for its own sake, that theology stands on its own feet and has its own internal coherence. But at the same time, and with equal strength, I've always believed that theology ought to try and speak to the concerns and interests and questions of the people in our own time. It ought to show that it has power to illuminate the current things that people are worried about and concerned about and interested in.
So you have argued that Jesus was in fact a refugee. Can you tell us more about what may be controversial about that? What are some of the reasons why people may disagree with that assertion that Jesus was a refugee?
Well, I guess the term refugee is itself contested. I mean, there is a discipline now called refugee studies, which is quite one of the more recent disciplines in Oxford, where I was when I wrote this article. There's actually a whole institute called the Refugee Studies Centre, which was founded in 1983. So that gives you a sense of how young this discipline is. And like every discipline, one of the questions that is constantly debated and argued about is what the actual word means. You know, those of us in theology know that one of the big questions that we're always asking is, what is theology? And in philosophy, you're always asking, what is philosophy? Mm-hmm. And in refugee studies, you're always asking, what is a refugee? Mm-hmm. You know, there's the official 1951 definition from the 1951 Refugee Convention. Not sure if I can quote it offhand, but it's something like, a refugee is anyone who, owing to a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of religious identity, political disposition, and various other traits, is outside their place, country of origin, and is unable to return to their country of origin. And if you take that definition, many people might say that it's a bit anachronistic to take a definition from 1951, defined right after the UN Declaration of Human Rights, depending on a lot of modern political constructs like the modern nation state, and sort of apply that term back to first century, you know, New Testament times. But in many ways, you can see how the Holy Family does sort of fit the definition, because the circumstances under which Jesus, Mary, and Joseph fled, at least according to the Gospel of Matthew, has to do with Herod trying to kill them, or trying to kill Jesus anyway. So that's, and because he's a Jew. So there's well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of ethnic and religious identity. So it fits it there. I think it's not so much in dispute whether or not Jesus was a refugee. What's in dispute is perhaps how that and why that is relevant for contemporary political debates, right?
So what have been some of the, just to contextualize your work a bit more before we get into the real substance of it, what have been some of the Christian responses to the refugee crisis? If that you're aware of course they're infinitely complex, but some major themes and maybe divergences that you've noticed in your work and studies.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can probably describe two major types of responses that fit the two major sort of left-wing and right-wing sides of much contemporary political discourse, right? On the right wing, you've had a lot of reaction against an influx of immigrants into a nation because of the perceived threat to job security of the residents of that nation, the perceived threat to social cohesion as different cultures and values and ways of life enter that nation, and perhaps even the perceived threat to what are often called Judeo-Christian values, or just Christian values sometimes. We can talk about whether or not that's a valid category, but that's often the way that people on the right talk about their fear of immigration and the fear of threat that immigration has to the what they will define as a Christian nation. Mm-hmm. That's the response on the right. I think we're all quite aware of what some of those responses have looked like in various Western nations. And then, of course, on the left, there's been a very strong call to embrace and welcome the immigrant, embrace and welcome the refugee, to provide for their needs, to there's even been quite radical calls for the policy of open borders, which just means don't restrict any kind of entry or exit from a nation, just let anybody live wherever they want to live. Not everybody on the left believes that that's a viable policy that they should advocate for, but there are some people who argue that that's the logical conclusion of a certain way of thinking. So we're in the middle of, yeah, quite a sort of historic trajectory of immigration has become very much a dominant fact of contemporary culture, contemporary Western culture and society. And we've got two very diverging responses to it from Christians.
On the one hand, you talk about our identification as humans as being refugee, at least in some way, because that's how Jesus was identified as refugee. And so we as humans are in kind of this, maybe this might be too strong, but like an ontological refugee status.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that seems true to me. That seems right in a whole lot of ways. But the other piece of that, right, is another sense of refugee, which has like deep existential and historical realities to them. So, for example, this is just on my mind, and there was a 9-month blockade of Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh. It was cut off by Azerbaijan, and so the people were starving.
Okay.
No electricity. Now Azerbaijan is shutting down access to UN, to others. So thinking about sort of, we'll call it the ontological refugee versus the existential refugee. Maybe those are bad categories perhaps, but I think you get what I'm getting at.
Yeah, totally.
So these are very different experiences of refugee. Like on the one hand, I'm happy and I think it's right to say I am a refugee in the ontological sense, but I'm very comfortable drinking my coffee, having this conversation with you this afternoon. While on the other hand, there's other instances of children being chased into the forest and then murdered in the forest.
Yeah, absolutely.
So draw that existential connection more for me. Perhaps on the one hand, maybe the historical ethnic cleansing, which so easily leads to genocide, is an analogy for that spiritual life, so we can get a better understanding of that spiritual reality of refugee. But draw that connection for me in your thinking.
Totally. That's a very valid question. And I want to tread very carefully here. I want to be sensitive, because what I didn't want to do in this article was try to minimize the very real trauma mm-hmm. of actual historical refugeehood that we see in the world today, just by saying, well, it's a condition that we all share because of, you know, we're all displaced from the Garden of Eden. And so we're all, you know, in this situation of not being in the homeland that we originally belonged to. Like, my point was really to do quite the opposite of minimize the significance of historical refugees. So I have to sort of walk a very careful line here. I think what I would like to start by saying is you've just described a really horrendous, you know, very violent and evil situation of great suffering in a historical event. What I want to say is that that suffering and the sort of general ontological displacement that every human being experiences as a result of, you know, the theological category of the fool, those both have the same root.
Yeah.
That the one wouldn't be there if the other wasn't also there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another way of saying that we live in a fallen world, right? Yeah. What I'm trying to do in the article is to show how many of these classical theological categories that we're all very familiar with if we've studied any systematic theology, and often very familiar with if we've just gone to church for a number of years and listened to sermons, many of these basic theological categories have a relevance to the question of how to think about refugees. They have a refugee angle, a refugee spin on them. And in the question of the doctrine of the fool, the spin is, well, we're all displaced. We're all refugees from the Garden of Eden. And that's why we should see ourselves in solidarity with those who are experiencing historical refugeehood in the present day. Does that help explain a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there seems, though, like a follow-up question to that, which is, and here I'm thinking of the work of Willie James Jennings, if you're familiar with him, in that.
Yeah, a little bit.
That separation from land, that displacement of the refugee, of ethnic cleansing, shapes identity in such a way that, for him at least, it creates the possibility for whiteness and otherness. And I think that, like, that's a very different kind of reality or sense of self and self-understanding that is different than me being a refugee sitting here drinking coffee, having a lovely conversation with you on a Wednesday afternoon.
So can you repeat that? So Willie James Jennings is arguing that the displacement creates the possibility of
whiteness.
Or in other words, the situation of comfort and non-displacement, right?
Well, that, yeah. On the one hand, the reality of displacement and the creation of white spaces, on the one hand, that what I've called the existential, is the creation of more comfortable spaces, or it's very, like, doesn't seem like those kind of same possibilities are open up to the refugee, the way you've described refugee with regards to the ontological end of it. And so,
yeah,
just cashing out that for that distinction and the relation between them.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Willie James Jennings. I think what he's getting at is very different to what I'm getting at, even though what he's getting at has a great deal of validity. Because it seems to me that what he's referencing indirectly is the fact that the historical displacement that white people imposed on the nations that they colonized, especially in North America, but also elsewhere. So whiteness caused displacement, but then also the fact that white people are an ongoing cause of the continuing displacement, like refugee camps, for example, by the fact that they're refusing to welcome these people into their borders. So there's a double white element to the current situation of displacement. It was both caused by white people and is maintained, in a sense, by the rich and privileged. And I think the point of my article is really to try and turn around and say, but are we really so different fundamentally from refugees, so different that we can see ourselves as justified in preventing them from entering our borders?
Yeah.
So Bonnie, what you're saying actually is that the seeing, in Ricoeur's words, you know, oneself as another, seeing that those who experience, those who are refugees, cannot be or should not be othered as refugees, because there is, in a sense, that all human beings share in that condition. That doesn't therefore mean that, oh, well, we're all refugees, so, you know, the distinction between actual refugees and just like, and anyone else doesn't matter. You're saying that
seeing that continuity means that we should take all the more seriously the refugee crisis.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's precisely why it does matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes me think of the way early Christians were thinking about Isaiah 61, which is that, you know, the herald Messiah brings good news to the poor.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. in one sense, the early Christians saw themselves as those people who were spiritually impoverished and needed release from captivity to sin. And so Jesus comes and releases them from sin. But the way that they then actualized that was, I think, of Galatians 1. What we need to do, therefore, is to remember the poor. We need to have a preference for the poor because we were all in that situation. And therefore, because we're all the poor to whom Jesus preaches and releases, therefore, it is all the more incumbent upon us that we care for the poor. And I just see that kind of continuity as like not erasing the distinction, right? But actually establishing an obligation to care for this category of people.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an analogous connection between spiritual poverty and material poverty. And I mean, any careful reader of the Bible has to acknowledge the importance given to both, right? Mm-hmm. And the connection made between them, that just because we're all spiritually poor, and Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit in Matthew, mm-hmm. doesn't mean that because we're all spiritually poor, we shouldn't care about the actual physical poor. Yeah. Because in Luke, Jesus says, blessed are the poor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a complicated issue, especially trying to draw on that language of otherness and othering, which I actually pointed to in my article. It can be very confusing to people who are not initiated into that discourse, partly because there's actually two discourses about the other which contradict each other. You know, there's the discourse about the other that you get in continental philosophy. That's the field that I was trained in, that I did my PhD in, where there ought to be the other. You know, the otherness of the other is to be respected. You shouldn't try to assimilate the other to the self.
Mm-hmm.
So then respecting and recognizing the otherness of the other is your ethical priority. But then there's this whole other discourse in social theory where we try to eliminate the category of other by welcome and by inclusion and by bringing everybody into our same group, as it were. And there's a sort of tension between those two ethical ways of talking about the other, even though I think they've both got stuff to offer. What I'd like to suggest is that we go to Paul Ricoeur as a way of mediating those, because Paul Ricoeur says, look, you can't respect the otherness of the other unless you have a reason for doing so. And your reason for doing so has to be the sameness of the other, that we both participate in some common humanity, which is my reason for having an obligation to respect them and to care for them and to stand in solidarity with them. Mm-hmm. And that's where this whole idea of we're all refugees ontologically connects to the idea, well, that's why we ought to stand in solidarity with those who are refugees, who we see as other.
Mm.
To your continental philosophy point, I remember this Theodore Adorno quote, which I'm getting through Edward Said, so sorry about this, but he said, it is part of morality not to be at home in one's home, which I thought was, in this context, is a very interesting comment.
Yeah, that's very relevant. And the theology of home has a strong bearing. It impinges on what I'm doing, which I would call the theology of refugees.
Yeah.
You know, I love the fact that the theology of home is gaining prominence right now with the book published by Miroslav Volf and Ryan McNally-Lintz, you know, because one of the things I'm trying to do by this idea of we're all refugees is to say, if we forget that we're all actually refugees, then we might come to think of ourselves as belonging where we are. Mm. And it's out of that psychological sense of security that we start to feel a sense of entitlement, a sense of I have the right to the land that I'm standing on. Therefore, I have a right to defend it from other people. Therefore, I want to keep these immigrants out. It all begins from a forgetfulness of our own status as refugees.
So So a question I have, you know, the title of your piece is Jesus was a refugee, not we are all refugees or something along those lines. So there is a Christological point, it seems, right, that you want to bring home. And I'm wondering if you could tease that out a little bit further, the ways in which Jesus uniquely was a refugee or something along those lines, or perhaps reflections on Matthew 25 and sort of the ethical sort of imperatives that are derived from that in terms of Jesus's teachings about how if you care for the least of these, you've done it unto me.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'm probably not going to talk about Matthew 25, not because it isn't relevant, but because in my own sort of work, I've created a sort of two different categories of how to think about refugees in the Bible. One category is the experiences and narratives that relate to forced migration in the Bible. And that's what this article is about. And the other category is ethical injunctions to the host about how to deal with refugees. And the Matthew 25 sort of falls into that whole other category.
Sure.
But no, to answer your question, I mean, I guess there's two elements to it. The first element is Jesus was a refugee was kind of an entry point. You know, I started this whole research project on the theology of refugees, and I kept coming across popular books and articles and academic books and academic articles and blog posts and everything on this topic of how Christians ought to think about refugees. And basically every single one of them, I can't think of any exceptions, mentioned that Jesus was a refugee and did little more than mention it. They just sort of threw it offhand as if it was kind of self-evident why that was relevant or why it was important. And perhaps there was just some sort of, oh, you know, if you had encountered Jesus in today's context, you wouldn't have welcomed him or you wouldn't have accepted him. And doesn't that make you feel bad? You know, that kind of thing. But I began to realize we're all just assuming that we know the significance of the fact that Jesus was a refugee. But actually, what if the significance is not obvious and needs to be unpacked a little bit? So that's where I sort of started in the article. And yeah, in the article, I get to the idea that actually Jesus' refugeehood points to the refugeehood of the displacement of all of humanity from the Garden of Eden. But it doesn't. That's not the only thing it does. It also points to a special kind of displacement that the body of Christ, you know, to use that sort of ecclesiological language, that Jesus' own followers and the church that Jesus established experiences because they are Jesus' body and because they are the church. And that's perhaps a different kind of refugeehood. It's a refugeehood that is perhaps more commonly spoken of as Christians being aliens and strangers in the world. Now, I'm aware that here I'm treading on slightly controversial territory, and I know Logan wrote a storm of tweets.
You're fine, don't worry.
No, it's relevant. Yeah, you know, about how you know the First Peter shouldn't be described, shouldn't be seen as addressed to the church in exile because the word exile is a different word, all that kind of stuff. No, I really appreciated that set of tweets, and I thought it was a valuable contribution. I didn't really engage with the theology of exile in this article. Mainly because I felt like it addresses a different set of questions, and it's just a different topic, you know.
Totally.
And it's already been done quite a lot. There's a lot of theologies of exile out there already. There's not very many theologies of refugees. So I wanted to show how the specific refugeehood of Jesus is carried on in the church in a very precise way, which the New Testament frequently references, and not just the New Testament, but post-apostolic texts as well. But of course, that's also a dangerous thing to say, because it's a language, the language of we don't belong here, we're foreigners, you know, we're aliens, we're strangers. That language is also used by those on the right of the political persuasion as a reason for having a sort of persecution complex or a fortress mentality, you know, or as a reason for just not engaging in politics. There's lots of things you can do with self-attribution as being an alien, self-attribution as not belonging here. And not all of those things are necessarily beneficial or spiritually healthy. So I wanted to show how we need to be careful with the idea that Jesus' refugeehood leads to our own distinctive refugeehood as the church. And there's right and wrong ways of using it. Don't know if that helps answer your question or if you have follow-up questions from that.
So I just want to read, I really love the first, well, one of the paragraphs in your article that I really appreciate is the first kind of conclusion paragraph. And I just want to read a couple of lines from it and ask you to expand on something.
Please.
But I also think I just love this. So Jesus was a refugee for three reasons. One, to recapitulate the displacement of God's people, Israel, of whom he is the final representative and summation. Two, to identify with the displacement of all humanity from the Garden of Eden as symbolized by the exile of Adam and Eve. Three, to lead the church by example into understanding itself as exiles and strangers in the world, a community made up of those whose true citizenship is in heaven. Through their identification with Christ, Christian self-identity as foreign in a truer sense than any temporal foreigner. Wait, through their identification with Christ, Christians self-identify as foreign in a truer sense than any temporal foreigner in an earthly nation. And you say some more stuff about that, but for the sake of time, I won't read the rest of the awesome paragraph, so people can go read it. But I really want to focus on that last part. I think there's a lot of rich points in there summarizing all the threads. But when you talk about Christians self-identifying as foreign, how does that intersect with the concerns you mentioned earlier about protecting or enacting the idea of a Christian nation? Mm-hmm. And I know you talk about the kind of different senses in which that people may use that. But I wonder, how those things kind of come in, interact with each other once there is this discourse about Christian nation discourse in various areas. And then also, but what you talk about self-identifying as as foreign or as stranger or as displaced and with citizenship in heaven in one respect. How might those things intersect?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's a lot I could say about that, but I'd love to hear your guys' views as well. What have you heard recently in recent years is used and meant by this language of a Christian nation? Do you hear it used where you are?
Yeah, I think it's pretty common in America, especially in the last couple of years, of like a Christian nationalism as a certain way of approaching or thinking about what America is, and the Christians' relationship to it, or the way that Christians have shaped the nation. And so that these kind of Christian values are baked into our constitution, for example, or into our laws. And thus, like, a kind of going back to, back to when, America was had good Christian values. And so I hear it a lot in that way.
Make America great again.
Yeah, I was trying not to say it, but there it is.
Yeah.
Call it out.
Barney, maybe you have heard this as well, but I mean, in the UK context, I mostly hear British values, or at least that's what stuck out to me from when I did prevent training for my current job, which for those who are uninitiated, it's basically a very interesting, to put it lightly, way of training people to recognize if your students are getting radicalized. And they attempt to be very... not racist about this, but I'm not sure they totally succeed. But one of the things they invoke regularly throughout that course is British values this, British values that, which I found curious for a number of reasons. But I feel like the Christian stuff probably does exist in various subsectors of the UK, but it doesn't seem as loud.
No, maybe it's less prominent in the UK. It is less prominent. Yeah. And I don't actually know why, because there's all the same... political ingredients, and there's a right wing in the UK. There's a lot of hostility towards refugees and immigrants in the UK, and there's also an obvious connection between church and state, a stronger connection actually than there is in the US. But for some reason, people don't draw on this language of we're a Christian nation. I see it in America. I see it in Australia. I see it in Germany. to perhaps a slightly lesser degree in France, but not so much in the UK. But yeah, like, I think we need to ask ourselves what we mean by a Christian nation, or what we ought to mean by a Christian nation, a nation that is composed of people who are baptized, or is it a nation whose laws reflect Christian principles, or is it a nation governed entirely by Christians, or is it a nation where everybody in it is Christian, which would mean, of course, that if any non-Christian wanted to enter the nation, they would be banished, they would be not allowed in, and if anybody within the nation lost their faith, they would be kicked out. And then you've got to ask yourself, is that a Christian attitude? And then you land yourself in all kinds of paradoxes, right?
And
I think those paradoxes need to be dwelt on, because I think they affect both right-wing and left-wing politics, or they cause problems for both sides. You know, on the right-wing side, I'll never forget seeing a tweet once by some American Republican politician, don't remember his name, who showed just a photo of all of these people fleeing from the Afghan war in 2019. Yeah. And he just wrote underneath, to protect our Judeo-Christian values, we must fight this with all our might.
Dear, wow.
And I thought to myself, what does he mean by Judeo-Christian values if they include shutting the door on people in desperate need who have just lost their homes? In what sense are we protecting Judeo-Christian values if we are violating one of the central manifestations of the gospel by refusing help to people who need it? So that's a problem for those on the right, but it's also a problem for those on the left, because we've got to ask ourselves if what our manifestation of Christian values means unqualified and endless welcome and incorporation and inclusion, what happens when that, or if that inclusion starts to undermine the very inclusive values that we want to maintain, you know? So I think really the whole question of a Christian nation needs a much deeper dive into the political into like proper political theology. I'm not sure I'm the right person to do that, but I just became aware as I was doing this project that it touches on very pervasive problems in political theology that nobody's really solved yet, about how Christians ought to wield power. We all know about the mistakes of the way Christians have wielded power in history. Everybody's taught them in high school, you know, but we haven't yet figured out how Christians ought to wield power in a way that is still sort of servant-hearted and open and welcoming.
Or the use of power to empower the powerless.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Unless they would use their newly given power to undermine that principle of empowering the powerless, right?
Yeah. So that brings me to the kind of obvious practical question, which you mention at the end of your article, but you might say this is kind of outside my bounds, but you say, you know, what I'm not calling for is just to open up all the borders, right? You're not just saying, I mean, that's one response, right? But you're saying that's not what I'm saying people need to do. But I guess, you know, someone might respond and say, yeah, this is great, kind of like thinking through like Jesus as a refugee, whatever, whatever. But it's just not practical to just let, you know, huge, you know, amounts of groups of people to just influx into countries. It's not feasible. It's not going to work. It's going to, you know, upend the economy and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, it's nice that you thought these theological thoughts, but, you know, this isn't really practical, right? I mean, this is like this one potential response, right?
So yeah, totally.
What is, I mean, and it's not that there's necessarily like one easy answer to this, but like, what are some of the things that maybe people can start thinking about and work towards in terms of like actually implementing some of this, what you've said theologically, in a real tangible political way?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I'm not sure we've got time to unpack all of those objections. Yes. But I think what I'll say is there's a few books out there which deal with this quite well. They go systematically through the objections to refugee welcome that are practical, that are about the role of the economy, about preserving cultural values, about all of those kinds of things, about opening the door to terrorists. So one book that's very American focused is called Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Refugee Crisis, or something like that, which has three different authors, Matthew Sorens, Stefan Bauman, and somebody else. Another book which is broader, more global in scope, is by two brothers called Mark Glanville and Luke Glanville. It's called Refuge Reimagined. But basically what they do is they show how perhaps as Christians, we ought to welcome people even if it's detrimental to our economy, mm-hmm. and even if it decreases national security, perhaps up to a point. If you're welcoming in a known terrorist, there might be good Christian reasons not to do that. But you don't even have to get that far, because you say as Christians, the strength of the economy shouldn't be our top priority. You know, you don't even need to go that far, because there's a lot of economic evidence to show that the economy is actually only strengthened by immigration overall, and the refugees don't pose as much of a threat, as much of a terrorist threat, even as native citizens do, if you look at the actual count of terrorist attacks and other kinds of deaths and violence. Refugees are a negligible, insignificant amount, even proportionally. So you can go through many of those objections and just show how they're actually just founded on not very good statistics, or just not very good evidence.
Fear.
And then you can say, well, even if they were, it would make no difference to us as Christians anyway.
Yeah. To follow up from that too, it's been my experience, and the kinds of things that I read and think about too, is that a lot of the stuff that that is communicated by at least American politicians is just blatantly false. And John ever so quietly said fear. It's like, it's this sort of fear mongering in order to, win votes, or whatever the motivation might be for that particular politician at that time. But the narratives that we're told, the statistics even that we're given, are just blatantly false. And so in some ways it's hard to have the debate about open borders, or what are the goods, what are the drawbacks of these kinds of things, if we as a citizenry, as the people, are not given all the necessary and correct information to make those kinds of decisions. We are not a well-informed a people.
No, absolutely. And I think actually that this whole refugee immigration topic is really just one instance or case study in a much bigger and wider question, which is about the current state of all the different political topics that we debate with, the current polarization in Western political discourse, the echo chambers that we create, the post-truth society, all of those kinds of things. And I'm trying to use the refugee thing really as one small focus to address some of those wider issues. But really those wider issues are, how do we regain dialogue with each other? How do we restore trust? How do we actually start debating actual facts rather than distorted misinformation? How do we restore enough trust in our political opponents that we actually respect each other enough to have a proper conversation rather than just shouting at each other? And I think that's, we all need to be working on that, no matter what particular locus we are studying.
One sort of final question for you. In this, the category that we sort of set up, the ontological refugee, there's a sense in which we have come from some place, which you've talked about, Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden, and you've talked about Christ and some of these other early church or biblical narratives. Is there any sense, though, in your thinking of where we are going? Is there is there teleology, an eschatology, and in this category, in this way of thinking, in this frame of refugee, how would you talk about the goal, the end of from which we are trying to get to?
That's a great question. I mean, I certainly don't think that Christian eschatology should be all about a return to the Garden of Eden, as if just everything that's happened in history was just a big diversion and an aberration and a mistake, and we just want to go back to where we started. I very much believe that the Christian narrative of history includes a fall and a redemption, but is about much more than that. And history has its own validity and its own legitimacy. It's heading towards somewhere. You know, it starts in a garden, it ends in a city, as I'm sure you've heard said many times. And I think what we're really heading towards is a union of heaven and earth, which will feel like a final homecoming to all of us, to all of our souls, right? And I'm trying to be careful with my language there, because I'm very conscious of, I just hear N.T. Wright in the back of my mind getting very angry about this idea that we die and go to heaven, and heaven is our destination. But then I'm also conscious of Hans Boersma on the other side trying to restore some of the value of the idea of heaven as well. So I'm saying union of heaven and earth, mm-hmm. rather than specifying one or the other as our final destination. Those two will be united, and that will be where we all finally come home for the first time.
Well, Barney, that was a great conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you all so much. It's been a lot of fun.